Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks and the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and also at alexlinder.com as a permanent archive. Today we're going to finish Chapter 7 of James Mason's Siege, which is created from newsletters he wrote from 1980 to 1986. Chapter 7 is Strength and Spirit. We've already done two segments on it. Today we're going to do 7.17 through 7.27, which is the end, so page 359 to 382. 7.17 is culture and conditioning. Culture and conditioning. Culture is a subject not very often brought up in Siege because, in a revolutionary context, it tends to give the ring of something irrelevant. And in this jungleized milieu where some of our own best fighters enjoy nothing better than rock music, it might even appear as a flat-out waste of time. But it is important to know and understand what culture really is, and in doing so, come to understand better about human behavior and the effects of the stimuli around us on it. First, true culture comes from blood. Here today we have a bastardized culture, just the same as the makeup of the American people grows increasingly bastardized. Then, as the old-timers will readily attest, there is the role of the Jew in what has been called, quote, culture distortion, for his own peculiar purposes and toward his own particular ends. In truth, the West today has no culture. These consumers hang on to the language and customs of a bygone age because they can't come up with anything so organized and intricate on their own. Some of the music aficionados will travel and sit for hours and pay huge sums of money to hear music played of 100 or 200 years ago. Music isn't being written anymore, and the language is degenerating into a mass of you knows, freels, and motherfuckers, etc. They might tell you that, in a democratic society, it's a matter of free choice or of personal taste. Our side will affirm there is such as the mass taste, in quotes, which will always tend toward mediocrity. But the trick, as always, about any so-called democracy, is that it is one big loophole, gaping wide like an open invitation to all the sharpies and hucksters to move in and take over. That is what already took place here generations ago. And then the question of free choice becomes a moot one, as it is all relegated to only those choices the tastemakers see fit to place before you. Control of mass taste and opinion is absolutely no different than control of so-called democratic elections. The manipulators present two of their favorite dummies for you to pick from. Either way, you lose. I'll use myself this time as a case in point. My meeting with my own culture was by complete accident. I could have been no more than 10 years of age when, over the FM radio of my father's car, I caught the sounds of music such as I had never heard before. I didn't know what it was or who wrote it, but I knew it was reaching out to me. And I must emphasize that it reached out not as anything prescribed socially, but instead like a call of the wild. Here was culture, and, as a product of blood, something in my blood was responding. After I had managed to get together a basic selection of classical and romantic music, I found out it has been one of Brahms's Hungarian dances. Blood to blood. The feeling was identical to learning the name of a beautiful girl one has seen on the street and fallen instantly in love with. Then there is conditioning. I had experienced the syndrome long before Commander Rockwell explained it in his Rockwell report. I can still go to my LP records and put on the turntable a piece of musical trash, but I will instantly be transported to a happy time and place, and the overall effect will be a pleasant one. The commander called it Pavlovian in principle, and he was quite right. Pavlov was the Russian scientist who experimented in conditioning dogs through the use of flashing lights, ringing bells, and even electrical impulses at their feeding time. Once the dogs had become accustomed to all the artificial and extraneous conditions, and had come to associate them with the most pleasurable and essential matter of eating, the experiment was proven. Place the food before the dogs without the lights and bells, and the dogs wouldn't go near it. Flash the lights and ring the bells, and the dogs would slaver at the mouth, even in the presence of no food. Humans don't like to think that they are no different in their instincts and reflexes than these dogs. How perfect is the system's brainwash and conditioning apparatus? It is total and complete. No matter who you are, where you are, or what you are doing, if you have on a radio, recorded player, or television, the system is there, and you are being conditioned. The logical result has been that all this noise and claptrap has become social ritual. Without it, forget it. You're not a part. The occurrence I experienced of the black who happened upon the playing of a symphony on a portable FM radio and inquired, "Was dead?" is indicative, but not as troubling as the young white girl who couldn't bear to be alone in the bath without loud noise blaring over her radio. I've chosen music as my example in this, as it is an art form that cannot be idly or coldly stared at in a museum or gallery. It requires participation in the same manner as a stage play, etc. Music is emotional, and we've got a country full of badly emotionally disturbed people. Conditioning is everywhere, but it is not everything. There are those few who hear and respond to that call of the wild I spoke of. For someone who can't dance or play a musical instrument, I still believe I'm one who appreciates and loves the best music of our blood. I think of the masters who wrote it, Wagner and Liszt. And I know they weren't writing for the hell of it. Without words, the music is saying something. It is blood speaking to blood. How few can hear it, and how fewer still can understand it? How few even suspect or care? That is culture, and that is what is nearly completely lost. And that was Volume 14, Number 6, June 1985. 7.18. Conflict and Adversity. Most people run like hell at the first hint of real trouble. But their idea of trouble is so ridiculously low threshold that the word itself loses its meaning. I have two ideas pop into mind at the mention of the word trouble. One, a violent physical confrontation, one-on-one or between very small groups, wherein death or serious injury could come at any second. And two, a bottomless pit of quicksand involving an arrest and prosecution by the system, which could result in, again, death or permanent loss of liberty. That, to me, represents trouble, and I've run the risk of it routinely for 18 years. Anything less than those two amounts to varying degrees of a pain in the ass. For most, however, trouble in the first degree starts in earnest with spooks, ghosts, and goblins breaking loose and running amok through their childlike and undisciplined imaginations, playing on their fears and dark spots representing areas that are unknown to them. Violence, hardship, jail, ostracism, and all the rest are those very same dark places of the brain and the experience that all, quote, good citizens are supposed never to know. We, as professional revolutionaries, know them quite well and are on daily intimate terms with them. We, as a result, don't scare easy. Implications and threats are better names for ghosts and goblins in this modern-day reality. Only physical annihilation or the immediate prospect of should give us any pause. The rest is garbage, and it is for the teeming billions of the Earth's swine to cower before the remainder, just as Haitian savages would before voodoo. It's been said that pressure makes diamonds, and no truer words were ever spoken. I've had often occasion over the past 12 months to comment that you never know a person until you have known them under extreme stress. Most, instead of becoming diamonds, are reduced to coal dust in a hurry. But without these live ammo exercises in daily life, well before revolution spills over into the street, how are we to know who really is who? How are we to know, in fact, who we are ourselves, unless we are tested? Right-wing bullshit slinging and catfights are no test. Smears in print are no test. Power struggles among powerless contenders are no test. The old-style street demonstrations were kinds of real tests, as were the resulting entanglements with the system, not to mention the enemy in the street, and the pig bureaucracy. Only when you tangle with a real enemy who can cripple or kill you if you make a single false move can you accurately gauge your prowess in any area. When situations get hard, it first of all causes one to take a true stock accounting of the people and things around him. At those times, he can see the clearest of all, because he must if he is to fight well and survive. He must if he is to fight well and survive. Just as the hardest tests cull out weak individuals, they also cut out weakness in the strong individuals, and this is what accounts for the phenomenon of the strong getting even stronger under fire. The hardest trials are the great leaveners of men. Performance under prolonged stress is the only way of knowing, because all of the rest can be faked. Commander Rockwell called for men ready and willing to march into hell with him. He got only a handful, but look at the legend they created in 9 short years. What could be done with 1,000? 10,000? Conflict and adversity should be viewed as no particular problem, no big deal, just as part of the job. It comes with the territory. Once we see how we can deal with it and overcome it, and once we recognize what it does for us, then it should almost come to be viewed as an old and welcome friend. We must know the ways of adversity and be comfortable with them. Those who fear adversity and who spend their existences trying to keep it as a stranger, may the devil take and sacrifice. Volume 13, Number 6, June 1984. 719. When Struggle Ceases. Joseph Tomasi was fond of saying, those not busy being born are busy dying. Indeed, he was at that time in the midst of the struggle to see to it that National Socialism didn't die because of an established central control that refused to grow, to expand, to adapt. The result was as simple as it was predictable. Those that refused to grow died. Those that did change soon came to affect and influence the course of the entire movement. This is a law of nature. It applies universally, and there are no exceptions. But this segment has to do with that which the rightists and conservatives either can't recognize or refuse to come to grips with. That fundamental social historic fact of life which ruled out from the very beginning any chance of their strategies meeting with any success whatsoever. It is a question of knowing when death approaches, why and what can be done about it. Never having gone the more or less traditional route of being called a bigot or redneck or being prejudiced on any matter, as a small kid I used to have an almost affectionate admiration for the blacks, and one might possibly see how such an attitude could exist, especially in a child. And having been born a rebel, I really liked the effect they had on, not to mention their performance in, a classroom. I never became a liberal, or to use the vernacular of the 60s, a, quote, nigger lover, because I had always sensed that these people were alien, and I could always feel the element of resentment and even hostility that emanated from them. Still, at no time did I count myself as their enemy. Undoubtedly, the first among my very few bad personal brushes with the black race occurred when I was about 8 years old. This was well after these sentiments just outlined had already been formed. A chum and I were in the habit of hiking around the city and the area that immediately surrounds it. This day, as usual, we were equipped with packs and canteens, etc., and had set off toward the west. This was to take us to the southwest edge of town, the part largely inhabited by the blacks. Some trepidation had already attached itself to this course, but we figured the odds against anything untoward happening were fairly slim. No sooner had we approached the perimeter of the colored district than we encountered the approach of two black youths, several years older than ourselves, about a block away and closing in. It was clear to both of us that trouble seemed to be on the way, but my friend decided to take evasive action that, to me, appeared worse than futile. It appeared provocative. He crossed to the other side of the street. Had there been any doubts before as to whether something was about to happen, they were erased when one of the blacks also crossed over to the other side. In those days, I was noted for my ability to run like the wind, but I didn't entertain the thought that day. This was an obvious confrontation. All parties proceeded forward until contact was made. The tall, lanky mulatto who was now confronting me demanded a drink from my canteen. A similar scene was taking place directly across the street. What I was feeling at that moment, I would only years later come to know and identify. The exhilaration of the natural adrenaline coursing through my body in anticipation of the primal conflict which appeared imminent. The moderns, then and now, referred to it as fear. My refusal was as curt as it was unequivocal. There followed more demands, more physical menace, and more refusals, while, as though to illustrate the apparent despair of the situation, from my side vision came the scene of the other black hoisting my partner's canteen for his drink. Finally, my black grudgingly gave up and moved on. This one had been a bluff, but other later ones were not to be. I can only imagine the black conversation afterward, but my companion, after rejoining me, could only say, "You look nervous as hell." "Yes, but that's not where the difference was decided." And therein was perhaps a microcosm of the world conflict. We had something, and they figured to take it away. They even thought they had us sized up properly, and they were half right. A question of wills, perhaps. The great advantage that the third world elements have in the world and in our midst is that they struggle. It is not the aid and comfort lavished upon them by the Jews and bleeding heart liberals, though this is most assuredly considerable. Their greatest impetus today comes from those among their leaders who are claiming that they, as a group, have made no significant progress since the 1960s. This spurs them on to continued struggle. Idiotic rightists and conservatives take hollow consolation at the same words addressed to blacks and fall back to sleep. Struggle is the force of life itself. Where there is ample struggle, there is not only life, but also strength and all that attends. Struggle brings with it awareness and touch with reality. Whites perceive, even if unconsciously, that their struggle has been over for longer than they or any of their predecessors really can tell. When during the mid-60s, as a youth in junior high school, a classroom of mixed blacks and whites was collectively chanting, "Black power, black power," the explanation one white offered me later was that there was already white power and that black power was the only fair thing. By instinct alone, that didn't wash at all with me, even though at 12 or 13 I was unable to articulate in my mind exactly why. In fact, there was no, quote, power at all, only a pie of which everyone wanted a piece. And just as nature decrees everywhere, the most and biggest pieces go to the most aggressive. Struggle. Commander Rockwell did a superb, unsurpassable job in outlining and explaining why the workings of this society and the behavior of whites in general were going haywire. And I won't attempt to recover that ground. I will propose to determine what was at the bottom of it all. That whites had no goal left to them as a people, while all the other races did. To wit, to gain for themselves all the material riches and technological wonders in the hands of whites. Hitler and his National Socialists were blessed with a very sudden and real sense of struggle which made possible their miracle. Americans particularly have been bombarded from birth with the idea that they must have it all, that they have it made, and that they now must share it, give it all away. Their instinctive search for struggle cannot be denied, only perverted. Or the instinctive search for struggle cannot be denied, only perverted. We see today limitless individual struggle, as meaningless as it is empty. not the mark of a great society, but that of a helpless one, one that is lost. No longer a great people, but just a mass of mean, mediocre, little nothings. Ripe for any downfall, but incapable of any greatness. Without struggle, identity is lost. Lack of uphill push results in increasingly downhill momentum. Without the unifying bond, a people becomes estranged from itself, from its past, its present, and its future. That is the reason for the otherwise inexplicable decay. And that is why there is no quick fix or shot-in-the-arm remedy can be entertained as real. There is also the answer to why all the so-called pro-white efforts fail without exception. What we must find are more and better ways to distance ourselves from the knee-jerk reactionaries, the mere anti-Semites, the mere racists. If this society were not ripe for death, would it so willingly hearken to the Jewish and liberal song of death? This is tautology, and it's circular arguing. He does quite a bit of it, actually. Would it cooperate so readily? No, my comrades, the struggle and the cry must be for that which is pro-revolutionary exclusively. A political army sharing a common struggle. Do not be deceived any longer. Volume 15, Number 2, February 1986. 7.20, dedicated to my enemies. This segment was conceived and notes for it put down during a moment of depression. When running on an even keel, not to mention while feeling elated, one finds that it isn't easy to discuss a last-ditch frame of mind. Needless to say, one can find good and bad moments under practically any and all circumstances, but when things get miserable and tend to remain that way over extended periods, the difference is usually made between people who can or cannot find a way, some means of tying a knot and hanging on when they have reached the end of their rope. I know. I've been there. Often. And sometimes for years at a stretch. And I promise you that I would not be here now had I not quickly learned where and what upon to focus my attention during those dangerously low times. In this saddest period of man's history, when all do indeed either fall silent or become untrue, when all meaning and purpose seem to fade and vanish, and it is either difficult or impossible to believe even in oneself, to whom can you turn for the strength to carry on? What can provide the jolt to the senses to snap you out of it and put you back on the fighting track? Who else but one's own circle of enemies? When you wouldn't carry on for so-called, quote, friends, after you've already given yourself up for dead, when even the cause itself appears lost, as long as there are those personal adversaries out there who might just gain some tiny degree of vindication at one's fall, there has always been given the one single reason to go on to the end. Beyond the absolute fact that a man without enemies is worthless as a friend, there is the equally powerful truth that a man's enemies can and do serve a definite use in his life struggle. Again, when everything has lost its meaning and worth, the presence of a string of enemies can provide a reason for life. I've never been disappointed or betrayed by an enemy. To them, I am number one and rate special attention accordingly. They do me honor in this way when all others have forsaken or turned their backs. When life itself has taken on every aspect of a bad joke, it becomes reduced to a kind of game where the object is to keep building, keep winning, for no other reason than to confound one's enemies. Probably unbeknownst to them, over the years they have each and all provided direction where there had been only aimlessness. They have instilled resolve where there had been resignation. I am sorry indeed to have to say that I could make no such dedication as this to any supposed comrade or friend. Perhaps a handful of longtime readers of my output will recall some of my more lengthy dissertations on those whom I felt were doing a great disservice to the movement, and perhaps they will remember these as smears, quote-unquote, of a sort. Note always that I never claimed to have been undone by, nor did I ever attempt to put the blame on any of those named or alluded to in those exposés, but that I instead carefully pointed out the mistakes that had been made, for whatever purpose, so that they might be recognized and not repeated in the future. No, my enemies cannot undo me. Only I can do that. As long as my enemies are around, new ones coming after the old, then they shall be my own best defense against that, by keeping me constantly alert and on my toes. Despite the debt that I may owe them, and that some of them who may read this could become ill at my revelation, I do not fool myself in false sentimentality about it. Enemies are enemies, and if allowed to build up or join forces against one, then he has invited his own doom. I view it as a war, and a war it is, indeed. I will kill them if I can. I owe them much. Call it vengeance or call it justice, whatever you will. As with most larger, more important things in life, I fear I owe them more than I can repay. Volume 12, Number 7, July 1984. 7.21. When indomitable wills despair. When this occurs, it is definitely time to look out. No greater dynamite, potential or otherwise, can I imagine. I know. I'm one and I know what I have in mind. This is the exact point at which revolution appears within any society. It, of course, at first, appears silently and unknown even to that person within whose brain it is beginning to hatch. It takes time to find its definition and take its form. It takes more time, still, to get into action and to manifest itself. But it always traces its start to within those who, in better times, would more likely be found among society's professional classes. When enough of these people despair of anything positive, then, truly, anything can happen. If there is anything that I desperately want to believe in, it is the old historic maxim that every action will result inevitably in an equal and opposite reaction. This, after all, would be the very thing we've all been waiting for, the pendulum to return. But I refuse to hold out any childish hope for anything that, in my carefully cultivated cynicism, qualifies as only a pretty theory. It was this feeling that led me from the right wing, where dreamers are forever building parties to take over the country and clean things up. No, as I have said in the past, this is Death Watch 2000, and only the most grim and remorseless can hope to make it all the way out to the end and be around for the final body count. This is where I intend to be. Not only is this where the revolution begins, it also happens to manifest itself as what the simple-minded and quaint see as, quote, evil. Nietzsche would understand, but precious few others could ever cope with it. Damned few can understand what it means to write your own rules as you go along, or doing whatever it is you have to do at the moment in order to get the mission accomplished. And only a fraction of a percent know what it means to carry on in this manner and yet possess the highest calling, to give a damn for nothing as it exists in the present circumstances and yet proceed in a coldly methodical pattern ever toward the highest ideal. Most aren't capable. In order to be able to do this, then, one must arrive at an understanding of those masses of people which surround him. The masses are approximately the same, regardless where you find them or during what time you find them. They have a way of killing their Christs. They'd kill us if given a good clean shot at it. A whole world full of one big Parisian mob. Never at any time are the masses to be found, quote, in the right of the most profound issues. By the time they have accepted these, they have long since gone stale and flat, just as with Christianity. They will forever reject and try to destroy that which is new and vital. This much of an understanding is necessary if one is not to bash his own brains out in a vain and gullible attempt at setting the world straight. A world, by the way, that doesn't want to be set straight. That was Volume 13, Number 6, June 1984. Seven 7.22, confused recollections. To me, this is what all so-called, quote, holy books, dating from timeless antiquity are. Confused recollections. They are all variations of one lost truth, which does go back to the beginning of, at least, man's own time. If the right meaning of these things was ever properly comprehended on Earth in the beginning, then they certainly have been lost and muddled by the time anyone first sought to capture them down in writing. Primitive attempts at explaining the misunderstood or the unknown. Stories dealing with the start and meaning of it all, so old and so retold, as to have long since taken on the air of nothing more than meaningless fairy tales. And how much was embellished along the way by opportunists seeking to terrify and control the method of super spookism. Once the practical history and meaning was lost, then in came the demand for blind faith in incomprehensible fables, hence the erection of the religions and churches. The ultimate cogent truth having been lost, the remainder thus is rendered meaningless and worse than meaningless, dangerous. For it sets the basis for all enforced unwisdom. This sort of thing is not the meat of revolutionaries. Volume 15, number 3, March 1986. The big if in quotes. To attack religion, any religion, is a foolish waste of time at best. Between ourselves, we may discuss anything and in intelligent terms, but the masses of people, whenever involved, have never yet been separated from their peculiar religious beliefs. If the communists of Eastern Europe weren't able to do it, then no one can. The question need not even be a matter of philosophy or ideology, but rather one of strategy. Do like the capitalist, and, lately, the communist, and get the church spouting exactly what you want it to through infiltration, etc. It merely helps keep down the friction. So much for that problem. We are not a mass movement, and this is not a mass publication, which is the only reason I, from time to time, even address the issue of religion and the revolutionary movement. And when speaking in terms of the movement, we are merely speaking of a core, a potential for something more greatly significant. Within this core is a large percentage of those who make their main thrust one of religion. Among these are some of the leaders, actual or potential, that I happen to trust and respect most. 99% of what they believe, preach, and write conforms to that shared by the rest of us in the movement. And by the rest of us, I'm undoubtedly referring to a minority. But that other 1% is where the danger is found that I take particular issue with. These people will tell you that we can't lose, no matter what. That at the very end of time, when the red hordes and the Antichrist, the swarms of subhumans, or whatever you will, just about have the white race, the race of angels, finished off, then God, or Jesus, or Michael will come bursting through the clouds at the head of a host of warrior angels and will save the day. Some, whether by belief or in order to make this sound more believable, make this tale analogous to the equally high hope of the flying saucers, which are even now supposed to be keeping close watch over earthly developments. It's funny, I was reading but right before I started taping this today that the hacker group Anonymous, or whatever it is, says that NASA is going to release proof of alien life. But UFOs were big back in the 70s, the 10 years before he wrote his newsletters. They'll tell you that without God or God's inspiration, all is to no avail and our best efforts are doomed from the start. They'll tell you that God has stated, "Vengeance is mine," and it is all out of our hands from the start. They'll tell you that Satan presently rules all the earth and is calling all the shots. All of this may well seem to fit the situation, that is, everything going to hell on a greased pole, with no visible resistance or effective opposition. To some, it may serve as an explanation of sorts, as a sop to an otherwise wounded self-image, as some sort of political wizard. Some of the more rough and ready among them, not to mention more realistic, will add that God expects you to fight for yourself and will only help those who help themselves. That is a little better, for it almost approaches the totally realistic view of one making his own luck. Have you ever studied or heard what the Muslims are saying and have been preaching for 3 decades and longer? It is almost the same thing, except for 2 important points. In this case, it is the black who is the, quote, Superman that is on an irreversible course. And it is a black Allah which smiles down on them, yes, from a mothership saucer. He must be talking about Nation of Islam, in their teeming billions as they prepare to swamp the white devils. The rest is a lot of mumbo-jumbo, all quite ridiculous. One thing I found exceptionally ironic is that they count those most responsible for their rapid ascension during this century, the Jews, as whites, saying, quote, they were the first out of the caves, and planning the same demise for them as for the rest of us. The answer, of course, is in the numbers and in the wire pullers behind the scenes, not in whose God happens to be on top. Blacks and whites alike are fools because neither side fully understands or appreciates the reason why things are the way they are. Blacks believe in their newfound invincibility, while whites are convinced of their own guilt and impending end, forgetting even the numbers involved for the time being and just removing the hidden alien Jewish factor, and the situation would begin to reverse itself practically overnight. A simple matter of control. Who's doing the controlling, and to what end? The new wave of thought within the movement states that we must stop thinking that the forthcoming end of the system and this society means the end of the white race or of higher culture. A defeatist will hold to that outmoded line, but a revolutionary will see the coming gradual collapse as a loosening of the very control that has led up to all of this in the first place. The intrepid won't worry about the end to convenience, luxuries, and amenities that the coming collapse will mean. Those who do allow it to concern them will, in all likelihood. To associate the facades of this crumbling civilization, the lifestyles and values of this decadent society, the, quote, knowledge of this backward culture, with the life of the white race, as it affects the limitless future, is to express a kind of oneness with and a desire and a willingness to go down with it, to the bitter end, waiting for some god to bail you out at the last possible moment. To an agnostic, that might be seen as one hell of a big if. Years ago, I gave up the terrific effort it required to be an agnostic, or pretend to be one, and admitted to myself and others that I was and am an atheist. In other words, there is no if factor. If we lose in our own, all alone, and we'll have lost for good. If we win, it'll only be because a few of us, but certainly enough of us, got smart in time and made the right moves. To me, there can be no ifs. We can lose, and we will lose, unless we do something to change the situation. No one and nothing outside of ourselves can or will step in to save us. Too many races and too many religions are saying the same things. There's historic explanation for that, but it only spells out further the confused, stayed, and lost meaning of religion. Worse than that, the white man is saddled with an alien religion, counter to his warrior nature, which is controlled by more aliens. And in this mess, he doesn't stand a chance at all. I personally reject all of it and am convinced that it is dangerous and that it is so self-deceiving. If it weren't, it'd be damn silly nonsense and fairy tales. I'm a believer in clear thought and strong action. I believe we are our own God and control our own fate. And I know that we can't leave any of this to chance or to an if. As far as the movement is concerned, let us use religion as a tool to lead others whose understanding is thus limited. We can't afford to pretend or accept for a moment that religion can ever lead us. Volume 13, Number 11, November 1984. "7.24, the most moral. I'm not in any danger of waxing religious, but at the same time, I've never made any bones about the fact that I am total fanatic, and true fanatics tend to come to resemble one another in various aspects. But in complete truth, many of these modern-day religious fanatics could take quite a few good lessons from an actual political fanatic. It offends me to see these Christians insulting their own religion through their light-hearted attitudes about it and their God, as it involves their own beliefs and lifestyles. After listening to and observing a few of them in action lately, I have come away with a feeling of absolute piety. I have always attacked moralism. I am not, nor have I ever been, a moralist. To me, that is a person who has been taught and who preaches a set of behavioral rules which run contrary to their nature. Consequently, they are forced to maintain practice, to hold tight vigilance over themselves, and even their thoughts, and to live their lives watching their steps, so to speak." Again, these mistakes, some of them are mine and some of them are the text is imperfect. "Human nature being what it is, they slip up regularly and must come crawling back to their God, asking for forgiveness. And the cycle starts all over again. Modern-day systematarians have provided themselves with endless alternatives that are equally fine and dandy with the new God, who is very hip, just so that they are able to work it out in their own minds that as long as they are somehow square with their Maker, any despicable thing goes. Revolutionaries have no such alternatives, no choices. Immoralities arise from frivolities, trivialities, materialism, leisure pursuit, and a dissipation and rottenness of spirit. And the constant preaching of morals is a sign of an intrinsically immoral society. Certainly the revolutionary attacks conventional morality as the height of hypocrisy. As with the sportsman and the hunter, as with the dog and the wolf, one kills for the pleasure of it, while the other kills because he has to. There is the morality. Everything the moralist does, he does in order to fool somebody, if only himself, in order to make the appearance of being righteous, or in order to steal a few moments of physical animal pleasure. Everything the revolutionary does, he does because he has to. There is the justification, and there lies complete and total morality. The revolutionary does nothing for the hell of it, does nothing for the fun of it, does nothing for the gratification or diversion of it. Revolutionaries possess the highest goal, the highest calling, and therefore anything is allowed. And in this same regard, it was Commander Rockwell who said, "Only failure is immoral." Volume 15, Number 3, March 1986. 7.25, Three Wishes. This will have very little to do with my politics or philosophy, but it does signify a certain state that I have arrived at in my 20th year with the movement. If everyone were to be able to stop and look back in reflection over the past the way I have done lately, it would be a good thing for most. I've often enough attacked indulging in wishful thinking, but I believe, in this case, I may allow myself this luxury by way of measuring where I've come from and where I'm at. First, I would wish that all of my enemies could be subjected to the same test that I have had to undergo heretofore. I confess my share of anxiety and discomfiture, but I manage to prevail in every case. I would like to watch them endure each crack and crumble when placed under the same trials and stresses that I had to cope with. Second, I would wish that in each separate contest, every challenge and every struggle, the actual physical circumstances could have been transposed to that of a battlefield. One of the greatest insults of the present day is the way, for the most part, any swine who seeks to offend or undo you can walk away, win or lose, with virtual impunity. I would want every hostile encounter to have been upon the field of honor, where the defeated do not get back up again to try later, and where one lives or dies according to one's actions, not words. Third, and most fondly of all, I would wish that I could time travel back 20 years and be able to be a constant companion and guide to my former self as a youth, those many long, uncertain years ago. To be able to compensate for the bitter moments, of which there were many, when I was as a kid, I had only lonely determination to sustain me. 20 years into the future, especially to an adolescent, is the future indeed. Those intending for themselves normal and average lives might balk at knowing what such a comparatively distant span of time might hold in store for them, and increasingly so in these most uncertain times. But to have laid claim to such a fanciful, outrageous, and impossible dream of what a life and career should be, to have burned, literally, all bridges behind, and to have achieved in reality what was but a personal dream at the start, is something one might take an appreciable share of satisfaction from. Not a bad personal roster of hopes and regrets. Volume 15, Number 3, March 1986. 7.26, 1,000 plagues, 1,000 curses. Among the things I have been since I first opened my eyes at birth is an atheist. But I've always been able to wax very, quote, religious, quoting scripture and even going so far as to get myself ordained for whenever the occasion demanded. It seems as though I'm always ready with a biblical connection to anything. Then, too, was one of the very first realizations I ever made on my own as a child, that this world, and especially this society, were on their way out. It irked me then only because I didn't want to share in its fate. I hated it. I wasn't part of it. I didn't want to go down with it. Then I encountered the movement with all the high plans of turning the mess around for the common good. Only then began my real education. And today, here I am with my own conclusions. I'm afraid it's back to the Bible connections, childishly simple hopes and fears, plus what was learned in a long sojourn with the movement. I've learned all the whys and wherefores. I have found out that historic trends are irreversible, unless you happen to be Adolf Hitler. And I still marvel at what can happen to a civilization and a people that defies and blasphemes God, or you could read it as tempts fate, once too often. One of the Christian tenets that invariably sticks in the craw of any real white man, second only to turn the other cheek, is that the meek shall inherit the earth. A lot has to do with the definition of terms. Meek, in this instance, refers to those with their eyes and ears open and their mouths shut. It has a lot to do with, quite simply, ceasing to butt one's head into a brick wall. While the rest speak out in meaningless blurbs, tomorrow's survivors will observe very carefully, but choose very wisely to stand mute and not cast pearls before swine. Did not the Lord state quite plainly that vengeance is mine? Upon considering our somewhat less than omnipotent position, who are we to argue that? It's too much to expect that these fools will be aware, or are aware now, of what's happening to them. There'll be no opportunity for "I told you so." But if we drop all nonsense right now and take only appropriate steps henceforth, we just might be able to hope that we will escape a wretched fate in common with those vast multitudes who so richly deserve it. If you're caught out there amidst the throngs when the time approaches, madly, futilely screaming and waving your arms in warning, you too will be trampled by the same four horsemen of the apocalypse. You may be getting the distinct impression by this time that I'll have no difficulty in grinning at all of this. As I said before, I'm no idealist. What we may hope for, realistically, is the total consumption of these people, together with their rotten system, before our eyes and through their own evil. What we may work for, realistically, is our own physical salvation, the maintenance of the quality of our lives, in order that we or our posterity may be the last on the scene to have, in essence, inherited the earth. I don't know how many are familiar with the Serenity Prayer, but a decent paraphrasing of it would go like this. Teach me to change the things that I am able. Teach me to accept those which I cannot. And teach me to know the difference between the two. During recent months, two things have loomed up unmistakably in my mind, and I have seen that most matters which used to cause so much sweat and anxiety, not to mention so much useless activity, can be bound up and dispensed with in two theses. If you have in the past disassociated yourself from any kind of mess, then just allow it, them, to be their own best answer. If you are presently working to rid yourself of or extricate yourself from an entanglement, then proceed to do so with the same amount of care and consideration and afterthought as you would to evacuating your bowels. The fight to survive will be a full-time job. Leave the rest to themselves. That is the worst penalty, slime to slime. In the end, we will remain, and our hands will be perfectly clean. That was Volume 15, Number 6, June 1986. This was the final issue of Siege. And finally for this chapter, 7.27, Their Money's Worth. History's judgment is shifting and coming into focus gradually on that large chunk of the U.S. population least worthy of a place in any future. The middle-class consumers are not only getting their full money's worth from their efforts at keeping the economy and the system going by working their pig jobs and paying their taxes, but they'll be receiving huge dividends in times to come. They keep in line, keep voting, keep the beast system alive and in power, and in return they are raped, robbed, beaten, murdered, betrayed. They and their children are turned into vile things, not resembling actual human beings. Their numbers are reduced, while the numbers of the coloreds are increased. They are among the first to disown and attack us and continue to embrace the world enemy. And for this, they will continue to take the coward's pummeling from their hard taskmaster in exchange for a few more months or years of cheap plastic thrills and hollow pleasures. While we are under some of the worst pressure we'll ever have to face, today, in the present, and while they go about making money as part of the business as usual, the question in the backs of their minds must be, what, if any, future this all has? We, on the other hand, have little to worry about. When the final awakening comes, and catches probably the majority of the rest completely unprepared, they'll experience the agony of how it could be happening to them. Those of us still around at that time will be saying over them, "Die, guy." Volume 12, Number 8, August 1983. And that was the conclusion of Chapter 7 of James Mason's Siege. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you with more from Siege real soon.